Sahana bhavatu, sahana bhunaktu, saha viryam karavavahai, tejasvinavatitamastu ma vidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shanti. Bhavantu sadarshana sadhanani. Bhavantu sadarshana sadhanani. Parasya nama kritibhissa paryaha. Parasya nama kritibhissa paryaha. Sadvastuni prapta taratma bhava. Sadvastuni prapta taratma bhava. Nishtaiva sadarshanam ityavehi. Nishtaiva sadarshanam ityavehi. Bhavantu sat darshana sadhanani parasya nama akritibhi saparyaha sad vastuni prapta tad atma bhava nishta eva sad darshanam iti avehi. He says, first line, Bhavantu Siddharshana Sadhanani. He says, let the sadhanas, let the means for attaining the vision of the Sat, the vision of reality, the vision of the truth, the Siddharshana, let the sadhanas, Bhavantu is a imperative third person singular for Sanskrit people. Siddharshana sadhanani nindanamata plural. Let the sadhanas, let the means for gaining the darshana, the vision of sat, means the satcharananda, the reality, the satyam, for the truth. Let them be saparyaha, the work. Saparya means worship, you know, puja, the different pujas, or the different ways of worshipping. Pujas of means the paramatma, means Ishvara, the Satchitatma, the worship of the Satchit or the Absolute, the worship Parasya, the worship of the Absolute, Brahman. Let that be by means of Nama Akritibhihi, through the worship of, by means of names and forms, like all of the different forms of Ishvara, all of the different names for Ishvara, how we do japa mantra, we did repetition of mantras, repetition of the 1001 names of Vishnu, repetition of the visualization of all of the different forms of Ishvara, all of the different devatas, having an Ishta devata, you know, a form of the Lord, whether it be like Krishna or Ganesha or, you know, whatever, or just the Ishvara Sarupa, Hiranyagarbha, the whole Virat. All of this that we experience through the Maya of Upadi, let those all be sadhanas for the mind, for the vision of sat. So I'll explain all this in a minute. Just kind of understand it now. Understand the words. Then he says that sat vastuni, in reference to the sat vastu, the vastu, that which is sat. The vastu means a thing. Something which is. So the set, the thing which is set, that which is set, propped of it, atma bhava, nishta, he says, sad darshanam iti avehi. But he says, may you know that, avehi, may you know that this, though, that the darshanam of sat is really, the actual seeing, the recognition of the sat, is really that nishta, that state of being, which is the Atma Bhava, the state of being yourself. The Siddharshana is just the Nishta, the mind's, you know, total absorption in a sense, the mind's recognition of your own nature, the mind sitting in your own nature, recognizing your own nature. That really is that really is what the attainment is in terms of the Siddhvastu. So that is really the Siddharshana. Okay, let me explain it, and then I can make more sense of this for you. Siddharshana in order to gain this knowledge, there's two sadhanas, two different types of sadhanas. One type is called upayanishta. Upayanishta means a commitment to those sadhanas, those means that bring about antikarna shuddhi, that bring about a mind that has a relative shanti, a mind that has an abiding, a relatively abiding peace. So a mind, for instance, let's put it like this way. By the practice of dharma, just dharma, living a dharmic life in this world, you gain a relative shanti. By doing japa, you gain a relative shanti. By doing karma yoga, you know, where you see really everything as Ishwara and you accept all of the results of your actions as prasad from Bhagawan. Seeing the world as Ishwara, having a continual relationship with Ishwara in terms of your Ishta Devata, you know. Say Vishnu is your, Krishna is your Ishta Devata. Citing the, you know, Vishnu Sahasranama over and over and over, where you continually, continually appreciate Ishwara in that form. Doing pujas, all of this type of thing. These are all means for bringing about a relative purity of mind. And that relative purity of mind is necessary in order to gain knowledge. Because without a relative shanti, and you can say without an ego, the regular, the ahankara that has been kind of dissipated somewhat, you know, through your relationship with the Lord and through this, the practice of dharma. I think finished in the practice of dharma, where dharma comes first, you're subservient to dharma. In other words, if it's not dharmic, you don't do it. The dharma is something stronger than your likes and dislikes. I choose dharma first. If the desire is not in accordance with dharma, or if my action is not in accordance with dharma, then I choose the dharma. Okay, that gives me the buddhi a tremendous strength, because you're no longer, what is primary for you is no longer pleasure, right? Or the avoidance of pain. What is primary is dharma. Dharma trumps. And if that's the situation, that's tremendous freedom from likes and dislikes. Just that. Tremendous freedom from being ruled by my likes and dislikes. Tremendous freedom from being ruled by the behavior or the actions of others, you know. And so the practice of dharma, and then again, the practice of karma yoga, where I take everything that happens to me as prasad. You know, it's as though Bhagawan, if you go to the temple and Bhagawan, you know, they've finished the puja and then they're giving out the prasad, you accept the prasad because it's from Ishwara. You don't think twice about it. It's prasad. So what if you have that prasad buddhi toward everything that comes your way? You take it as being from Ishwara. And that way, then you take it, whether it's whatever the situation may be, but then you are responding to something, a situation which has been given to you by Ishwara. In fact, that is the reality, in the sense that whole creation is Ishwara. And so every moment that you find yourself in is Ishwara. You know, it's not anybody else. And so that's a gift from Ishwara. You can take it as Ishwara prasad. And so when you accept it like that, then what do you do with it? The situation is prasad, whatever it is. Like Swamiji will joke, you know, in telling this story, the prasad could be a drop of water. It's just a drop of water that's put into your hand. And then that drop of water, you know, is not just thrown out. You know, it's, you go like this and you put it on your head, you know, you get, it's prasad. It could also be, you know, a laddu, or it could be a whole meal on a banana leaf. The prasad can be anything. But it is prasad, whatever it is. And so that's the attitude. That attitude toward the creation also, you know, neutralizes your likes and dislikes, because the primary relationship is a relationship with Ishwara. And that's how you interpret. That's the lens through which you interpret the situations that you find yourself in. And if you think about it, situation by situation by situation, you find yourself in, and you in fact are responding to the situation that is there. Situation, response, situation, response. Right? And so, in fact, your life, in a sense, is a series of responses. You know, so how are you responding? If you're responding to Ishwara, then that's the prasada buddhi. And so here, all of these things, and Swamiji will talk so much about dharma, because the whole order of the creation, this is the whole order of the creation that you find yourself in, is Ishwara's order. And then dharma is the appropriate response to Ishwara's order, you know. And so that Ishwara Arpana Buddhi, a buddhi means the commitment of your mind, is toward your worship of Ishwara, your acknowledgement of Ishwara. And all of this is Ishwara. So here, when Ramana says, you know, let your worship of Bhagavan, of Ishwara, Parasya, Saparayaha, let your puja, the ways that you worship Ishwara, by means of all of the names and forms, like all of the forms of Ishwara, all of the names of Ishwara. In fact, anything can be a form of Ishwara. Everything is Ishwara. But you can see everything as a form of Ishwara, or you can, it's in the commentary, it says, you know, Shiva, Vishnu, Brahma, Indra, etc., Hiranyagarbha, all of the murtis, Virat, the whole Ishwara Sarupa, all of these are forms of Ishwara. There's so many names of Ishwara, of the Lord. Let your worship of the Lord, with by means of all of these names and forms, let that be, you know, your sadhana, the sadhana for siddharshana, for seeing the truth, for seeing the reality. How is it the sadhana? Does it mean that, well, if I do all of the karma yoga, if I follow dharma, if I do all of these pujas, continual japa, will that give me knowledge? That itself is not the primary means for knowledge, but it takes you to knowledge. Mm. The punya of it takes you to a guru, and the punya of it also gives you the antakarna shuddhi, the attitude of mind that makes you, first of all, seek the knowledge, and then when you come to the teacher, at that time you come with a mind that is capable of gaining this knowledge. If you come to a teacher through some karma, some great punya, you come to a teacher, that itself is a blessing. They view, you know, a mahatma, they view that just to come into the presence of a teacher and to get that drishti, even the side glance of a mahatma, is considered a great, great blessing, you know. And that, well, you'll carry that with you into the next life, you know, if you're not a mumukshu, you know. But you can have that grace, that blessing, and that teaching taking place. You know, you say your parents, for a young person, your parents bring you, you know, that teaching, correct teaching with the pramana, as a pramana, all of that is taking place. That's tremendous punya. But you are not yet a mumukshu, right? That type of buddhi is not there. And so even though you're sitting there before this teaching, the mind is totally preoccupied, you know, with what am I going to do next, and what's going to happen here, and I need to get this, I need this kind of money, and so-and-so did this. You're totally engaged in the samsara, sitting in the presence of that teaching. The teaching still, bless, I mean, it'll squeak its way, find its way in there somehow. But the person isn't really available to it. Now, that's for somebody who's not a mumukshu at all. But say, when you come to this teaching, when you come to the teaching from a state of samsara, you know. You may have done a lot of kind of vichara. Vichara means analysis, where you yourself are recognizing this can't be all that's there. There has to be something more, please. There must be something more. You come with that type of buddhi, and what is that? There's no way here to attain the type of fullness and happiness that I seek. But you come with that, some degree of that, adhikaritvam, of being a qualified student. You come with some, everybody comes with some degree of that. Not totally. you come totally with it, with that, then you just have to hear it once and you can walk away, it's all over with. but we don't have that. We come with, you know, kind of a lot of likes and dislikes, you know, vairagya in this, where a certain dispassion in this area, but certainly not in this area. And it's just different levels of vairagya and the lack of vairagya. So our mind isn't coming to this knowledge with a deep shanti and with dharma as what is primary, you know, or we're seeing everything as Ishwara, right, so that we can accept everything that happens to us as prasad. We can come with that, right? We develop that karma yoga buddhi as we are gaining this knowledge. The two go together. The karma yoga buddhi, seeing this as Ishwara, seeing everything in terms of my behavior, in terms of dharma, that is all something that is given to you as part of this knowledge. But that part of it creates an attitude of mind that brings about a relative shanti. But that itself is not the knowledge, really. That practice is not the knowledge. The knowledge is recognizing that the self of all of this is my being. That's what the knowledge is. And so we look at that devotion and worship of Ishwara, where I am a bhakta to the Lord. But that being, that relationship being primary, that karma yoga buddhi as being primary to gaining the antakarana shuddhi, because if I'm, when I'm worshipping Ishwara, you know, and accepting everything as prasad from Ishwara, at that time I'm not saying necessarily that I am Ishwara, but I have an attitude toward the creation, even though Dvaita is there, myself as a bhakta, and then in worshipping Ishwara, I have an attitude which gives me a mind that is almost identical to the mind that a jnani has. You know, in fact, Krishna says that in the Bhagavad Gita, that karma yoga buddhi gives you the shanti that a jnani has. You know, because still I'm seeing everything as Ishwara, even though I'm there as a jiva in the mix. So when I have that level of shanti, and I get that itself also from this teaching, the resolution of all of that is when I gain knowledge of who I am really, you know, amidst all of this. Start out that bhakta, you know, where I'm a devotee of Bhagawan. And then I realize that the self of Bhagawan is myself. That knowledge takes place by what we call upayanishta. So upayanishta is the attitudes that bring about a mind that has that relative shanti. That's the karma yoga, dharma, upasana, you know, meditation, puja, all of these things that bring me into relationship with Ishwara, really. You know, brings about all of those things that bring me into relationship with Ishwara. And then also different techniques like upasana, where I can sit with my eyes closed and just hold a vision of the Lord. That gives me what we call antakarana naischalya. Antakarana naischalya means that if I come to the teaching, come to this teaching, and even though I'm listening, my mind, I just can't hold it steady. I can't keep it in one place. And so there's exercises that you can do to help make the mind hold steady. And one of them is called upasana. Or say you have an ishtadevata. You can actually meditate upon that. That you can have a visualization of the Lord in a given form and hold that visualization. So there's a lot of different upasanas where you're guided into the holding a visualization of the Lord, meditating on the Lord, until all there is that form. And that brings about a steadiness of mind. That's a certain technique. And then also the different ashuddhi, where your likes and dislikes really get in your way and cause you a lot of pain. This person has to be like this. This person has to be like this. I need this and I don't need that. All of these things that become kind of driving forces in order to neutralize that. You really have karma yoga. Dharma, karma yoga. Dharma and karma yoga go together. You know, where I take that everything is prasad from the Lord. You know, and then again also in meditative exercises like pranayama or japa. All of these are upayas. They're all means for bringing about a relative peace of mind. But that's not it. Now you have a relative peace of mind and you still want to know. Right? You have shanti. You still want to know. But you have a mind that is capable of knowing. Mm. It's that mind that has to present itself in front of the teacher. You know, it's not that you're working for shanti, you know, a relative shanti, and to say, okay, now I have the relative shanti. Now I have antakarna shuddhi. Good, I've accomplished antakarna shuddhi. That's not enough. That antakarna shuddhi just brings the mind into a state where you're now capable of doing shravana, manana, nididhyasana. Shravana, manana, nididhyasana is the sadhana for gaining self-knowledge. The karma yoga, etc., is the sadhana for gaining bhakti, is the sadhana for gaining a mind that is capable of doing shravana, manana, nididhyasana. Remember, shravana is listening for newer people. Shravana is listening to the teaching, listening to the unfoldment of the Upanishad and these type of texts that we're teaching. Listening to it so that you gain the vision of the Upanishad. Manana is answering all of the doubts that you might have about what that vision, whether or not you think that vision is true. You know? Shravana itself will answer all kinds of doubts for you about what it is the Upanishad is saying. So the unfolding of the vision of the Upanishads and using logic and understanding so that you really understand that the vision is saying this and not something else, that's shravana. Mm-hmm. Once as that becomes clear, then your mind will have a different type of doubt, and that's manana. Clearing up that is manana. The different type of doubt is, why is it like that? I know this is what the Upanishad says. Why is that true? Why can't it be like this? The resolution of those type of doubts, doubts on whether what the Upanishad says is true or not, that's manana. But really, you know, I think this isn't really clearly grasped in the West or in academics. Academics is weak, I feel, in this area. Before you can do manana, analyzing whether what the Upanishad or some text is saying, whether or not it is true, before you can analyze that or really say anything at all about it, you have to know what it says. Right? I mean, it doesn't seem obvious. So the first thing is to really see clearly what the Upanishads, understand clearly what the Upanishads are saying. And then there's plenty of room, and it's appropriate for you then to question, well, why can't it be like this or why can't it be like that versus what the Upanishads are saying. That makes complete sense. But that we tend to do manana on something before we even know what is being said. And that's problematic. You know, it doesn't ever give you a chance to really understand something. And then doing the manana makes it much deeper. So shravana, and then upon the shravana, the clarity that you gain from the shravana, then manana, even though in reality they're all coming at the same time, but still you have to have that. You have to understand what the two are and that one is dependent upon the other. Manana depends upon shravana, right? And nididhyasana also depends upon shravana, because the Upanishad has something to reveal to you to make you see, to make you recognize at the time of teaching. That's why it's a pramana. That's why it's a means of knowledge. But then when you see it, we have literally lifetimes, beginningless lifetimes of taking ourselves to be the physical body, mind, sense organs living in this world. It's a jiva jagadishwara. I'm the jiva, this is the jagat, this is the universe, and then there's the Lord. That trinity, you know, there's that threesome there, the triad, is all we know really. And so the vision comes along and it makes you recognize that, no, I am actually the whole. But when you walk out the door, you know, they use the example of that you come to class, this vision is taking place, and in a swamp, it's like opening the reeds. You know, and you look down, and you see this water. There it is, clear as can be. But then if you lift up your hands, the weeds, the reeds just close over, and you look and there's only reeds there. Where was the water? Where'd the water go? You know? And so people have that experience. You come to class and everything is, you know, opened up. You see so clearly. And by the time you're on the sidewalk, you know, it's gone. Closes over again. And so what Nididhyasana is meant for is to neutralize, to help you drop the dehatma buddhi, that natural conviction born of ajnana, born of ignorance, that I am this body, mind, sense organs. And so contemplation is really, is to have the mind sitting with what you have seen and recognized at the time of teaching. Like, for instance, in Nididhyasana, it slows everything down. So say if you were to say, you know, suggest Aham Shantihi, and or Chaitanyoham, I am consciousness, or Ishwaroham, I am Ishwara. You, those words now mean something because you've seen it at the time of teaching, you know. Or asangoham, I am a sangha, means nothing ever touches me in any way, nothing can change me in any way. But those words, you, when you say those words, if you've seen it, recognized it at the time of teaching, then when you bring those words back to you, they point to the reality of it. They point to the truth of the words because you already know what the truth of the words is. Like, say for instance, say we say a sangha, asangoham, I am a sangha, I am unattached. If I just translate, I am unattached, I am unattached, I am unattached. What does that mean? Who am I unattached to? What's unattached to what? See, it doesn't mean anything. Say if you say, I am consciousness, I am consciousness. I know I am consciousness, but I know I am consciousness as this body, mind, sense organs. You know? Or I am Shanti, I am peace, I am peace, I am peace. Okay, my mind is quiet, I am peaceful right now. So it doesn't mean anything. It just means what you think it means within samsara. But Nididhyasana is when the words are loaded with the truth of the words. You know, so that when you say, I am consciousness, for instance, it's because you have the word consciousness, that word points to your being, which is consciousness, non-dual consciousness. Or I am Purnaha, I am fullness. It points to the ananda which you are, not a bliss state of mind. And so Nididhyasana is totally dependent upon shravana, as is manana. And what it does is just allow your mind to sit there and get to know yourself, right? To just sit. To have to take the time to just sit and be with yourself. And so the mind itself gets used to recognizing itself in reference to you. And as it does that, it recognizes that I am the one who is always present, changelessly present, can never be touched in any way. It just gives the mind a chance to sit with yourself. And what happens then is that what we call the dehatma buddhi. Buddhi here means the conviction that the self is the deha, the body. So dehatma buddhi, deha atma buddhi. That conviction that it's like a knowledge. It's a mithya jnana, it's a false knowledge, but it's like the conviction that I am this body. Body means this body, mind, sense organs. So that's what we come with. And it's quite a big thing for the ahankara, the I am, to shift from this body, mind, sense organs to myself as Brahman. So that when the ahankara, just think now for your own experience, the I thought rises in your mind. It's always rising. I'm going to do this, I'm doing that, I'm listening to class right now, I. It's always rising. But if you were to slow down and think about your self-identity, where does this aham land for you? The I. When you say I or me, where does it land? Does it land on Brahman, on yourself as Brahman? Or does it land on the body, mind, sense organs? If it's self, like say every word has an object, right? lamp, the word lamp goes here. The word chair goes here. So if I say to you, and even if I say the generic word chair, chair comes to mind. If I say table, table comes to mind as you say it, right? Shirt, shirt comes to mind. So the word evokes the object. It's the name of the object, right? So now the word I. What is for you when you say I or I am? What finishes it? I am or I. Where does the word land? Does it land on yourself, which is as Brahman? It means the me that is absolutely changeless, that is present in every thought I have, that is never touched by anything, that is always the same, no matter what the mood or the emotion is. Is that where the I lands? Or does it land on the body? Or does it land on the body-mind complex? I mean, for an Ajnani, for somebody that doesn't have nishta, you know, rootedness, clarity in this knowledge, clarity without doubt, clarity without the Dehatma Buddhi, it definitely it lands on this body-mind sense organs complex. This is me. This is the I. So if I say I, I'm talking about me and nothing else. But when you gain knowledge, the I lands on yourself, the Atma, which is the truth of you. So the Ahankara is not Ahankara. Really, when we say Ahankara, we're talking about kind of the false I, the created I, the I that's a product of ignorance. So the Ahankara for a Jnani, for somebody who has knowledge, is called like a Dugdha Bija. It's a burnt seed. It's a Mithya Ahankara. It doesn't have any reality in terms of your own self-identity. It's like if I say, I think I'm going to go to the store and get I need to pick up some things at the store. So I think I'll go to the store. And then all of a sudden, I thought she had knowledge. Look at what she just said. So I'm going to go to the store. That's the body, mind, sense organs going to the store. She said she was going to the store. That's what we mean by it's mithya ahankara. It's a mithya ahankara. There's nobody inside that thinks that Atma has also all of a sudden turned into the body. That doesn't happen. But you just talk normally like a normal person, that's all. But if you're thinking about who you are, you're Brahman. You're the changeless being that you are. That is nishta. That nishta needs some time. And you gain this knowledge and you have some clarity at the time of teaching, but you walk out the door. And, you know, beginningless lifetimes worth of habitual response are going to kick in. And so Nididhyasana gives your mind a chance, you know, to sit with yourself, to recognize the difference between the thinking, feeling, acting, mind, the subject, object, all of these things, knower, known, all of these triads, as we'll see in a minute or next week. All of this activity, it gives it a chance to see the difference between me and all of this activity, you know? And all of these different things that we do, the thinking, the feeling, the acting, all of these things. We see I am there changelessly present, and that is me. It becomes very clear. But you need that Nididhyasana to help the mind. So Shravana, Manana, Nididhyasana, all of which depend upon Shravana, that is the sadhana, that is the direct sadhana for self-knowledge. The other is the direct sadhana for antakarana shuddhi, which is required. The mind, a certain amount of peace is required in order to be able to get that knowledge at the time of teaching. This antakarana shuddhi, purity of mind, is related to this teaching, not just to antakarana shuddhi. Let me go through life with antakarana shuddhi. That's a saintly person. That is not what's meant here. You need the antakarana shuddhi in order to be able to be in class, to have a mind that is able to even follow this teaching. This teaching is word after word, sentences after sentences after sentences, pouring down upon you. You know?
And nothing happens.
But your mind has to be present to receive that. You know, they even use the example, I don't know, I don't think it's just Swamiji's example. I think it's in one of these Prakarna Grunthas where if somebody gives you some burning embers, you know, you need kind of like a strong cauldron to be able to receive those burning embers, you know, and then you can take it home for your hearth and whatnot. You can't receive the burning embers with, you know, some newspaper. Yeah, the burning embers will just burn right through the newspaper. But like that, your buddhi, your mind, you know, has to be a cauldron that is capable of holding this knowledge. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, the knowledge will just burn through it and, you know, scatter on the floor. No. So, the whole antakarana shuddhi is only in relationship to gaining this knowledge. And this knowledge, of course, makes the antakarana shuddhi that you've gained, you know, along with this teaching, as something which is no longer relative. The shuddhi, or the peace, the shanti, the fullness of the Atma, is not a relative shanti. It's the shanti, the shanti and the peace and the ananda, or the wholeness and fullness of yourself, holds the ashanti of the mind. Yourself is never ashanti. It never has any agitation. It doesn't have any sorrow. It doesn't have any sadness. You know, it is exactly what it is at all times. It is a wholeness and a fullness that is present to the most sublime, beautiful vrittis, beautiful states of experience. And that same wholeness and fullness, in exactly the same, is present to the sorrowful vrittis also, the depressed vrittis, the angry vrittis. It's just that it's usually in neither one has it been discriminated. If there's the full happy vrittis, which everybody loves, there's still no discrimination between me, my changeless presence, and this happy vritti, these happy thoughts. And then, so the, now when the happy thoughts are gone, you know, the happy me is gone, and now I have the depressed thoughts. And of course, there's no discrimination there. I am depressed, I am happy, you know. So the happy me has become the depressed me. There's really no me there. There's just this fluctuating states of experience. For Jnani, there is no happy me or sad me. There's just me. And the nature of the I is of its, in its own right, ananda, or fullness. Mm. But not the ananda or fullness that we have equated to bliss states of mind or happy states of mind. So the one who really has knowledge, or what it means to have knowledge, is for the mind to have the nishtha, the clarity, in that discriminative knowledge of recognizing my being. So here he says, let these sadhanas, let all of these different sadhanas, these different ways of worshiping the Lord, let them be, you know, the sadhanas for being able to see, for the darshana of Sat, of the reality, of what is Sat. He says, but may you know that Sat darshana, the vision of the self, the vision of reality is this. It is that nishtha, that clarity. In what form? The clarity which is the nishtha, which is the Atma Bhava, the very nature of one's being. It's the attainment of that that is the Sadvastu. In reference to the Sadvastu, the Siddharshana is the... Let me explain nishtha a little bit more. Siddha, okay. Whether you have knowledge or not, your presence is completely there, me, the me, is completely there, pervasive to and present to every thought that I have. The problem is that there's no discrimination between me and the nature of the thought. So if the thought is happy or sad or agitated, still, with Ajnana, have no knowledge at all, you still are totally present to and pervasive of that thought, to that thought. That's why you can say, I am happy, I am sad, I am agitated, I am dull, I am whatever I'm doing, I am there. as the very substance and content of every experience I have. The problem is that I take myself to be that experience. I can't differentiate my presence from the experience I'm having. So what has to happen is there has to be a differentiation, a nishta, a clarity that differentiates my being, the Atma Bhava, the being of myself, from all of these things that are coming and going. That nishta, where the mind is does not become unclear. That's why Swamiji now translates nishta as clarity. There is no lack of clarity. There is clarity in reference to my own being. That really is the Siddharshana. When I have the clarity about my own being, I am the self of every experience I have. Ramana doesn't tend to go out into to differentiating one's experience from, how to say that? I talked a lot about this last week, basically like this. I see through my eyes and my sense organs this room. I see this room. This room that I'm seeing, that I'm experiencing right now, including my body, all of it is really experienced in the form of a thought modification. So if I have all my sense organs looking at this room, so I'm experiencing this room, you would think, but my mind is daydreaming, right? Even though my sense organs are all open, they all work perfectly. If I'm daydreaming right now, I'm not experiencing this room. I'm only experiencing the daydream, right? In order for me to experience this room and to be awesome with all of you, right, my mind is using my sense organs as an instrument. It doesn't need to. It can be lost in thought. It can be fantasizing. You know, it can be nodding off. It can be so many things, right? But in order to experience this room, though, the mind has to be using the sense organs so that the thought modification I have at this time is not a daydream. It's a thought modification that is born of my sense perception, right? But the sense organs don't work without the mind. So what I'm actually experiencing at any given time in this waking state is whatever thought modification I have. You see that? Mm-hmm. So it's either going to be a daydream or whatever, or it's going to be like a sense perception. Any sense perception, any thought modification is totally pervaded by me, right? I illumine the thought modification. I am present to the thought modification. I am the self of the thought modification. I don't think that's very hard for us to understand, especially if I ask you to, like, think of a pot or think of a flower. You know, that's a thought modification. It comes into your awareness. It is there. It goes out of your awareness. You are itself, right? The problem is, in this world, I have the thought modification, and I cannot, because of my dehatma buddhi, because of there's such a strong identification with this body, you know, I never recognize my being, that all that I'm really responding to is the thought modification, and I am the self of the thought modification. I don't even think about it like that. But in fact, the thought modifications come and go and come and go and come and go, and I remain exactly the same, pervading changelessly every thought modification I have. And so I need to recognize that. You know, I need to recognize that. And in recognizing it, I gain nishta in my Atma Bhava, my own being, because I am the one who is steady. Nothing's ever happening to me at all. Every experience I have is coming and going, coming and going, coming and going. But the Dehatma Buddhi is so strong that my mind, the Ahankar, is rooted here. And so I convert my experience continually to I am here and you are there, subject to object, within Ishwara's creation. Yeah? So now Ramana doesn't do a lot of make things very clear in this way because he's not so interested. What he wants you to recognize is that nothing ever happens to you. Your mind has to recognize that all these thought modifications, all the experiences that you have, and see all of it as Ishwara. This whole thing is Ishwara, but in the end, what you need to recognize is that you are the self of all of this. You are the changeless self of all of this. And it is that changeless self that is Sat. It's Sat because it's changeless. It actually exists. It is existence itself because it's changeless. If it comes and goes like everything else, then it can't possibly be Sat. Because it has a Sat on either side. It comes into being and goes out of being. There's only one thing that doesn't come into being then go out of being, and that is you. So that is the Sat Darshanam. The Darshanam of Sat is the recognition of yourself. But you are already here. And so it's not going to be a seeing, a darshana, a seeing of some Sat out here. Rather, it's the nishta, the clarity of your own, the clarity, the recognition of your own being, which is not a subject-object recognition. It's no atma out there to see. It's the mind's abiding in with clarity the bhava, the self that is already absolutely present. Mm-hmm. That's what it is. So he says, there is no, I mean, the only siddh-vastu that there is the atma. Right? That so the siddh-darshana is the recognition of that nishta in that self which you are. Appreciating all of this is Ishwara. You know, it's like, think like this. So if you just think of your mind only, the mind is Ishwara. If you're, I'm going to extend farther, but just for your own experience, the mind is Ishwara. Yeah, I don't know if this is too much, but anyway, the mind is Ishwara. Okay, now, for you, if there's just you and your mind, right, that's really, I am Ishwara. If there's just you and your mind, then you will say, I am Ishwara, right? Because there's nothing else. Now look, if in the mind, if the mind is like, there's you and your mind, that's all, but in this mind, in the vritti, you happen to take a character in it, like in a daydream. And now this character is relating to the rest of the mind as Ishwara. The character in the mind, in the thought, mm-hmm. which you've identified, mm-hmm. is worshipping everything in that mind as being Ishwara. Mm-hmm. Okay. In that act of that character within the mind, worshipping the rest of the mind as Ishwara and recognizing that it itself is held by Ishwara, you know, that brings about a relationship with the mind, you know, which is one of surrender, where everything is one of worship to the Lord and recognizing that everything that comes to me, right, is really from the Lord. But what is the truth is that the self of that character who is worshiping the whole mind as Ishwara is myself, and I in fact am Ishwara. I in fact am the one who is the self of that mind and the character in it. So the worship, the bhakti of the character in the mind is helpful because it dilutes the ahankara, because that character sees everything as Ishwara, and so in a sense erases itself. In a sense, relatively erases itself. Because it's everything it does is in surrender and an appreciation of Ishwara. But in the end, that character has to gain nishta in its own self, its own atma, which is the atma of Ishwara. Mm. You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. Now, even if we could just keep it like that, it would be really easy. You know, but the problem is we can use this mind as an illustration, and it's very helpful, and it's not that it's not true also. But here we are as the character in the big mind. Right? This body is that character in this infinite mind that we call Ishvara. Mm. And so I have to do what that little character in my mind has to do. That's what I have to do. And so that requires, you know, it's not just like that. Because there's a lot of things, because the reality of this body, mind, sense organs within this creation is so strong. If you open Kristen's door.
Yeah. Let me try to get that door open.
Oh, sorry, Edward. Are you okay?
Oh, yeah. The door is open.
Oops, okay. Go sit down, back down.
It's okay, Jimmy.
We just got back. Kristen and I just got back right before class. We got back from Seattle. Yeah, so Timmy has missed us. Sorry about that, Edward.
Yeah, my foot was asleep.
Oh no, I should have jumped up.
I was so concerned about Timmy. I thought, the heck with my foot, you know. It's okay.
Okay.
I think Tibby's got a winter coat. Looks fluffier.
Yeah. Okay, so anyway, that's kind of the task. You know, it's a good exercise. In fact, that's why I use the meadow imagination so much. You know, because you have to imagine yourself. And it's easy if you can do that, but then you have to make that jump. And that requires, you know, Shravana, Manana, Nididhyasana, continually recognizing, holding this teaching, seeing it over and over. Because for us, this world is not just our meadow imagination. But really, it is very much like the meadow imagination. It's not that different. You know, but it takes a lot of Shravana.
Go ahead, I'll catch up.
Okay. Pray for everybody?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's say our prayer. Purnamidah, Purnamidam, Purnat, Purnamidachate, Purnasya, Purnamadaya, Purnameva Vashishyate, Om Shanti Shanti Shanti, Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha, Hari Om.
Sometimes I feel like maintaining that steadiness of vision, like the whole Reed's example, it feels very hatha, like very, you know, like hard, you know, at times. And I guess I struggle with that a little bit, but. Yeah, at what point does it start feeling easier?
You know, I think one thing, there's different ways to kind of deal, different ways to kind of hold this vision, but one is just the one practice. If you do any kind of Nididhyasana, any meditative practice during, like in the morning, just to bring yourself to yourself so that you have some clarity in the morning, then you can, throughout the day, notice whether you're still there. Really, throughout the day, like, am I still there? Is my presence still there? Throughout different emotional states, am I still there? Because we tend to think of, and I think it's one real problem for even thinking about nishtha or clarity, is that we are looking for a mental state rather than seeing whether I am still present as I was in one type of mental state. Am I still present in the other? Like, it's easy, in this happy state, if I can only be happy all the time, you know. But what I would like you to see is, okay, here I am present to this happy state. And then when you're in a non-happy state, am I still there? And start seeing what I call the anuvritti. The anuvritti means the continual presence of myself, no matter what the mental state. That's one thing. And then let the mind start developing, I would say, developing a relationship with you, the one who is always there. You know, because in Nididhyasana, in fact, that's what we're doing. And in the end, you see that I am the very self of the thought, of everything, in fact. I'm the very truth of it. But you can start by having the mind come into relationship with your presence. You know, like it can notice, am I still there? Yes, I'm still there. Can it gain a kind of a friendship or a dependency, you know, as though that's the home base? This is the one place where it's safe to be dependent, because for the mind to be dependent, in fact, it's the only place for the mind to have a dependency, because yourself will never go, it will never change. Even if you want it to go, it won't go. You say, you just get out of here. Sorry. I'm immovable. Nothing can touch me. Nothing I can do. You know, so it won't leave you, it won't abandon you, it will never do anything. And it is whole and complete. So just don't put this kind of a false pressure on yourself where you're saying, I'm losing my knowledge because my mind is not behaving how I think it's, like, Jnani's mind is supposed to behave. You know, that settling down of the mind happens over time, as, you know, the things, the desires and things become less important to you over time as your mind settles down and the wholeness of yourself starts naturally filling that space that we used to have to rely on situations to fulfill. You know, like, I need this in order to have the shanti, in order to have a happy experience. What happens is that the mind starts letting the real source of ananda do that job, which is your own being. It starts counting on you for that. And more until that just becomes natural. The mind counts on you as for the source of the ananda, rather than that circuitous route where you try to fulfill a desire so that the mind has some shanti, so it temporarily feels some happiness as long as that shanti is there. That is a, we call it almost like a sukhalesha. It's just a little drip, like, or a little whiff of sukha. Whereas the self is different than this type of mental sukha. It's a sukha or a wholeness that's present even in dukkha, because you are there in dukkha as well as in sukha, you know. And so even when there's dukkha, there's sorrow or hurt, then the mind continues to learn how to go home to be soothed. There's no home in terms of any kind of distance. It's just the mind turning itself away from grasping out here to being soothed in here by the very self, by its very self. But it's not used to doing that. It's used to thrashing around looking for some salve out here in duality rather than coming home. And so I think it really helps to get over this thinking that you're holding this knowledge is that the shanta vritti is indicative of your holding the knowledge. I would say rather it's when your mind is hurt or in one state or another, your ability to bring it home. You see? And to recognize yourself in the middle of the different types of mental states. Let those mental states work themselves out over time. Well, they will. And you can't, it's too much to ask of the mind for it to have a total transformation after, you know, just like that, after lifetimes of Dehatma Buddhi, basically. It doesn't mean you don't have knowledge, though. It just means that the mind needs time to work through for that knowledge to totally, you know, work itself through all of the different types of feelings and emotions and needs that we have. They all drop off over time. That's why it's kind of nice, you know, year after year, you're in better shape.
It's an improvement.
You're continually improving because the mind is growing, you know, it's growing up in the light of this vision, you know. And all of your experiences are, as you gain, you know, clarity, all of the experiences that you have in the world are now coming up into a person who has this knowledge. And so that you integrate and work with them differently than you did before. You know. But the first time, they're going to show up just like they did the last time. The difference is, they're coming in more and more to somebody who has some understanding. And so your way of being with them is different, and they become neutralized and dropped off. Because in the end, you know, your mind, well, it's just not worth it to... It's not worth it to not just be objective and deal with the situations. It's not worth your effort or time. It's just creating sorrow. You know, it's better to take... All kinds of difficult situations happen. It's not like you gain knowledge and the world becomes really fluffy.
But you're always motivated on this, this plan of, let's work it out. We can work it out.
I think... That there's nothing wrong with wanting to work things out.
Yeah, but
not for the sake of your well-being. Not if that's the bottom line. I have to work this out so I can be happy. Mm-hmm. Happily, I have to work it out. You know, my ananda, I have to be dependent on the Atma for my wholeness, and then do the best I can with the power that has been given me. That's Mm-hmm. You know that one, you have to kind of dealt, you know, play the hand you've been dealt. We do have to play the hand we've been dealt, and we have to try to do it to the best of our ability.
Is that Kenny Rogers?
I know, said that.
No, at home.
What's the name of the, you know, when Ronald Reagan was shot?
Hinckley?
No, not Hinckley. His secretary, is that man?
Oh, yeah, the guy who got Bradley? Shot in the head.
Yeah.
Bradley.
He said that. Mm. After years of trying rehabilitation, he's very, very badly damaged, permanently damaged by that.
Brain damage
by that. But he was able to function. He had a life with his wife, so he lost so much. But he was being interviewed one day, and he said, well, and he had difficulty speaking and saying it, but this is what he said, you know, you just have to play the hand you've been dealt. It's true. You have to play the hand you've been dealt, because there's the hand. That's it. I really thought, I don't know. It moved me that he said that, and I also realized the truth of it. And you play it, if you have, as you gain some clarity in your knowledge, you can play it objectively. You know, it's the Ishwara. This is your hand, you know, and you have to deal with this, the challenge of the situation to the best of your ability. But if you have knowledge, there's some whole different vision going on. You know, you're the character in the meadow. And your commitment or your freedom is in yourself. It's the self that's free. There is nothing in samsara that is free. By its very nature, everything in samsara is bound by the opposites, bound by sukha and dukkha and pleasure and pain and birth and death, and on every level this is going on all the time. And for everybody. So it's not like you gain when you gain self-knowledge, the mind becomes free in its recognition of this myself is free. The mind still is an instrument. It still, you know, is bound within duality. But the truth of it is free. You're not bound. So I think that's an important recognition too, is that when we say talking about liberation, we're talking about the recognition of a liberated self. And that is the liberation of the mind. It's not that the mind itself becomes liberated. It's that it recognizes that I am liberated, that I am free. And that is its freedom. Yeah. And that the ananda and the fullness, that it, all it's been doing is running around seeking the self in samsara. And then it recognizes, I am the self. Right? That its self is free. And free of it also. It recognizes that its self is free and free of it. That's satyam mitya. You know the satyam mitya where the pot recognizes, ah, I am the clay. But it also recognizes that the clay is free of it. The clay is not dependent on a pot at all. And I'm not dependent on my mind or this universe at all. It's just I'm free. But the mind is also free because it recognizes in reality I'm nothing but the self. But the self doesn't require, and it's not dependent on the mind. So that's...
Well, is that what you mean when you say I am the mind and I am free of the mind?
Yeah. But you have to recognize, like, the mind, the truth of the mind is the self, but the self is free of the mind. Right? I mean, I'll never forget one thing that helped me so much in getting whatever I have in reference to this knowledge is one time Swamiji, many years ago, actually, he said, oh, my mind does all kinds of funny things. It does? It's just the mind. You know, it's just the mind. It's what do you do that's doing all these funny things? And for him, it's doing these funny things. You know? You can have all kinds of thoughts. But the thoughts are mitya, and you don't have to make the thoughts be any more than what they are. You know? Or build up a whole web. Around those thoughts. He won't do that, but for him, the thoughts are coming and going, and they're thoughts. That's all. They're not any more than that. And there's nobody hanging on and trying to construct an edifice around, you know. Mm-hmm. So the thoughts are bricks, and you build a house around yourself. They use in one of the, I forget where, in one of the texts, they use like for a jnani, the thoughts and experiences are like writing on water. How it, you know, erases itself as you write. It's happening, but it just erases itself. Another example they use is like a bird flying through the air. It doesn't leave any trail. You know? Those are nice examples. Your thoughts are flying through. They don't leave any trail. They don't. Nobody holding on.
But you can't force that position on yourself. It has to come out of...
It's not a matter of forcing the position. It's a matter of bringing your mind back to that position as it when it loses it, you know. That's what we do, is when your mind is being taken on a ride. You know, when we say bring the mind back, what does that mean? It just brings bring your knowledge to the, that behavior or to that build-up. And actually, sometimes your mind builds up and takes you on this ride and it's too powerful for the time being for you to do anything except get dragged along. Get dragged along, you know. But the mind will settle down. You know, and in the end, your knowledge always wins. Always. The mind can take you on a wild ride, but it will settle down and then you'll bring it back. Your knowledge will bring it back. Hmm. You know. And maybe the wild rides become less and less and less. But it just depends on your samskaras and what's important to you, and so many things. You have to give yourself some space. Shravana. People used to ask Swamiji all the time, how long do I need to do this shravana? when will I stop doing the shravana? You know? Keep doing the shravana until you don't. There's no need to not to do it, you know. There's even some little Shruti shloka that says punaha shravanam kuryat. How long do you have to do shravana? You should do shravana just again and again. Again and again. You know, until it's not a question. Until that question's not there. And then you can do it just for it. Swamiji all say something like, and then you can do it just because it's pleasing. It's for your own enjoyment. You know.
He says that about puja also. He says, as long as he's like a lasiba, you know, like a chore, you have to, you know,
keep doing it.
Yeah.
And then do it because you love to do it.
Yeah.
There's, I don't know if it was Coleman Barks or somebody that translated some verse of Rumi. Mm-hmm. It starts out, pain comes from resistance, joy comes from acceptance. You know, it's not the conditions of our lives. In other words, it's how we
are with it.
Relate to it.
Yeah. That's right. Okay, so let's go tonight. Hi, Chris.